your computer. And in that, you may or may not have been using OneDrive. But for those of you that have been using OneDrive and its flavors, let me explain something here because it's rather complex. And there really aren't any articles on it, so I don't think you're going to be getting the information from anywhere else. So OneDrive now has three different components. There's OneDrive Personal, which is associated with what's called your Microsoft account. And in your system tray, that is a little white icon. It's like a little white cloud. And then there's OneDrive for your work or school account, and that is a blue OneDrive icon in the system tray with like a white perimeter around it. And then there's OneDrive for Business, which is a whole separate agent, and that is used for syncing with SharePoint libraries. Now, what has happened over the last several months here, I'm going to go back, say, maybe 3 months, is that various things have happened with regards to ways that authentication happened. There was a OneDrive app that actually came out in the Windows Store for Windows 10. And so if you had Windows 10 and then you went and installed the OneDrive app, which is different than what's called a desktop app. So let me differentiate. You know how you've got these things called apps that they have on mobile devices? Well, there's things called apps that are also available to your Windows 10 computer through the Windows Store. So this is really the same as like a device store, the same as your Apple Store and the Google Play Store. And so those same apps that are available in that store also can be installed on your Windows mobile device as well. So these are intended to be more convenient and more integrated and things like that. Well, there was a bit of a conflict because if you used that and then you also had the desktop apps, otherwise known as the things that actually show up in your system tray on your computer, if you had them both installed, then there was going to be like a credentialing conflict. And of course, the app piece wouldn't work with your SharePoint sync libraries. And in reality, everything worked fine except for the SharePoint sync libraries. Well, something really interesting happened this week. And that is that Microsoft, for some computers, not all yet, which is something else that I found rather interesting, some computers seem to be taking a brand new massive update for Windows 10, but not all Windows 10 computers are getting this update. And it's literally a whole new build. Now, if you have BitLocker full encryption on your disk, this is fine because the update will temporarily disable BitLocker. It'll install the update, reboot however many times it needs to reboot. It's all hunky-dory fine. And what you end up with as a result is, oh my goodness, my SharePoint OneDrive sync libraries actually work again. So I noticed that the authentication box in the operating system itself has actually completely changed. And this authentication box that's showing up with the utilization of non-OneDrive things is just completely different. So kudos to Microsoft, because what they've actually managed to do is to fix the outstanding issue associated with OneDrive for Business app not working in an environment where multi-factor authentication was enabled on the account. So I highly encourage you, if you have Windows 10 and you're utilizing, first of all, if you're using Windows 10, install the update. But if you were having issues with OneDrive before, then I think this update will actually help correct the issue for you, because that is what I've seen on multiple computers now. Suddenly, oh, everything's working fine. Yay! So now let's get on to the whole topic of multi-factor authentication in more detail. So multi-factor authentication, it really demonstrates your presence in the authentication process. Multi-factor authentication utilizes a second component to the authentication that is something that changes. You know, it changes every 30 seconds or it changes every time it's used. If you're looking at something like a token system, like a YubiKey, the code that the YubiKey generates every time its authentication button is pressed, that is a unique code every time. So that requires your presence to actually push the button. Now, in the case of technological integrated, like app type multi-factor authentication, we've basically got three things that are on the market today. It's the apps on your phone. What we're talking about here is either the Azure Authenticator, the Google Authenticator, or the Microsoft Authenticator. And these function in typically one of two ways. We're talking about an app that displays a code that changes every 30 seconds. Alternatively, the app may be configured such that the server, once you're trying to authenticate to it, will actually send a code to your phone app, which then you have to accept or acknowledge. So again, this is a presence thing. It requires this. You are actually present and it's you. We know it's you because it's the app that you have on your phone. And the third piece here, the third option, is what's called text messaging, or otherwise known as SMS-based multi-factor authentication. Now, there are people that do not like SMS-based multi-factor authentication. I have a very practical viewpoint of it. My viewpoint is that would you rather have some multi-factor authentication or none? Well, the answer is obviously you'd like to have some rather than nothing. And in fact, as of August 1st, 2016, the Social Security Administration is going to mandatory multi-factor authentication using SMS-based authentication for all the SSA accounts. And I have to say, kudos to the SSA, really. Major kudos. They should have done this years ago, obviously. Yes, there are vulnerabilities that exist in SMS-based multi-factor authentication mechanisms. You know, if your phone is compromised, the bad guys who compromised your phone can intercept that text message. They can even do things like make it so that that text message never actually gets presented to you, so they'll receive it. There's redirection attacks, you know, but those are preventable. Either they're a nation-state attacker, or they are somebody who has cellular network root-level access. You know, or they're, you know, somebody who has tricked you into installing some sort of a malicious app on your phone. And, you know, that's, if you're going to accept things, if you're going to click, yes, install this evil thing on my phone, I can't help you. You know, there's an element of this where you have to take responsibility for getting trained and you know, utilizing common sense and not just accepting and installing things. And you know, this is no different than those people that installed the flashlight app and just said, "Oh yeah, I want the flashlight app," and then of course they've got a ton of spyware on their phone. You know, my solution to that is really use your phone for the very limited purpose that you should be using it for. It shouldn't be something that you're installing everything under the sun on. Because the more stuff you install on that phone, the more things you have as far as vulnerabilities that could potentially be stealing everything that's on your phone and compromising it, backdooring it, etc., etc. Okay. So the Social Security Administration is doing multi-factor authentication. I know you all have SSA accounts, so please go and hook this up. Now, LinkedIn has multi-factor authentication. Twitter has it. You know, most systems now have it, including even the availability for it to be utilized in an on-premise Active Directory environment. Please, please, please use multi-factor authentication. So, in terms of helping you better understand what the risk profile is here, I'm going to take you through a real-world example of somebody that was in Florida or that is in Florida that I assisted last week. And this person contacted me because their Office 365 account had been hacked for the third time. I guess three times a charm here. And because I'd actually talked to this person before, I said, you know, if you just implement multi-factor authentication, those issues are going to go away. So they woke up to find out that there was a ton of kickback emails that was evidence that somebody had gotten into their Office 365 mailbox and had utilized their credentials to send out a bunch of malicious emails and spam messages and, you know, generally unauthorized things. Now, this can really be devastating because imagine if somebody did that with your credentials, then it looks like now it's you who's sending out these messages. That could be absolutely devastating to your professional reputation. So, you know, if you think that, oh, multi-factor authentication is too difficult, then really consider the ramifications, okay? So I worked with this gentleman and he's telling me that his Twitter account was also compromised and that in his Twitter account credential security area, he was finding that there was a logon that was logged from Sweden. Now, of course, that could easily be somebody from Pakistan using Tor and you know, masking where the authentication came from and so forth. But you know, bad things had happened to his Twitter account as well. And I'm like, okay, so if you've got all this stuff happening to your accounts that you log on to using your workstation, then I am pretty well 100% guaranteeing you that your workstation is compromised and you've got a keystroke logger installed on that workstation. You know, or there is something malicious installed into the browsers that you are using to authenticate to these sites, and that basically every other password that you have is also compromised. And I certainly hope you're not doing online banking from that system. So, you know, looking at root cause analysis, number one, multi-factor authentication was not enabled on any of the accounts that were compromised. Two, there was no host-based security product on that computer. Which, I mean, that's a catastrophic fail right there because that's easily preventable to the tune of like $39 a year, whoopee-doo. Very easy to take care of. Three, no host-based security, or I mean, sorry, no perimeter security appliance in place and in use at the network. Major issue there, considering the fact that not a day goes by that my perimeter security appliance is not protecting me. I mean, like every single day, just browsing regular websites, everything is compromised these days. And if you do not have perimeter security appliance properly programmed, you will be getting hacked. I mean, it's just basically inevitable at this point because the hacks on websites are ubiquitous. So he didn't have that in place, and then he wasn't staying up to date on software patches on his workstation either. So, I mean, it was like basically running naked on the internet. So, what was the result going to be? So, let's go back to the MFA component of this. So, we go through and we set up multi-factor authentication, and it was actually very simple. It took less than an hour, including all of the training and verifying that. The MFA was working for him on his mobile device and his Outlook and everything else, you know. It's actually incredibly user-friendly to use multi-factor authentication, but you do need training. There is technique involved here. And I don't think you want to do it blind, you know, and this is something that I help people with. Generally, what I'll do is I'll train the IT manager about MFA, or I'll train, you know, the business owner, and then we'll turn on MFA for the rest of the staff. And then the business owner will train the staff, or the IT manager will train the staff. So it's very cost effective. But ultimately, this is the only thing that you have as a tool at your disposal to prevent unauthorized parties from logging into your accounts. Multi-factor authentication requires your presence. It requires that it's you to authenticate, and it requires that it's you right now to authenticate, as opposed to somebody who has snatched your second factor of authentication code from an hour ago and reused it. The code changes every 30 seconds. In the case of the YubiKey, it changes every time you press the button. So it really doesn't cost you anything more to use multi-factor authentication. It just takes a little time to set it up. And as I said, it's really not difficult at all. So there's really no reason that you shouldn't be doing it. And when I say it's the only tool you have at your disposal, I mean that because if you say, well, can't I just look at logs and figure out who's authenticating from where and have some sort of like visibility into that? The answer is no. Unless, you know, when you're looking at something like Twitter, yeah, okay, so they give you some visibility, but you don't get any like notifications on that, and there's no Intellimetrics to turn that off in terms of like behavioral analysis or machine learning. In terms of LinkedIn actually does a reasonably decent job where they'll send you an email notification and say, hey, somebody just tried to authenticate to your account using your credentials from, and then they'll give you typically a generalized location based upon the IP address that the authentication was coming from. So that's not bad. But now let's talk about Office 365. No, you have no visibility into that. Unless you have E5 licensing, which is very expensive, and even if you go and buy E5 licensing, you would then have to have an enterprise security architect with my level of skill, not somebody lesser, because believe me, this is not something that's simple and easy to set up. Your general in-house IT manager is not going to be able to handle setting this up. You literally need to have an enterprise security architect that has the ability to set this up to the point where then you would have the visibility and the machine learning and Intellimetrics to find out, oh, well, let's see. Bob logged in on his workstation in Kenosha, but then 5 minutes later, we got an authentication from Bulgaria. No, we're pretty darn sure that Bob is not in Bulgaria. And that system would be in place to literally just poof, turn off that authentication from Bulgaria. So, barring you having something that sophisticated with that sort of an active machine learning capability, you know, advanced threat detection is actually advanced threat analytics is what Microsoft calls it. But, you know, it has to all be programmed properly. They don't. No, nobody just turns this on by default because they don't want to deal with all of the support calls from people who have no idea what's going on with their Office 365 tenant. This is no different than if you just set up an Office 365 tenant, clutter's going to be enabled, which is bad. Archiving's going to be enabled, which is bad. You're not going to have any custom retention policies, which is really bad. Your anti-spam policies are going to be the default. There isn't going to be any quarantine, no end user quarantine notifications. I mean, it doesn't work. It's not workable. And I've actually seen the devastating effects of that because I've been working with a relatively new client who left their Office 365 tenant was set up by their former IT service provider, who's actually bankrupt and gone out of business now because they were so incompetent. You know, so yay free market economics. But nonetheless, their Office 365 tenant is so jacked up simply because it's just the defaults that all of their email, based upon the retention policies, that's older than 48 months, has just been deleted. Yes, it's just gone. So this is why I'm always telling people. If you're going to partner with somebody to get your stuff set up, you had better make sure that they know what they're doing. And speaking to that fact, I have to mention that I was contacted by a large agricultural implement franchise who I had talked to about Office 365 and all kinds of things. And in You know, instead of working with somebody like me who has incredible depth and demonstrable experience in Office 365 implementations to the tune of in excess of 30,000 mailboxes, they opted to go with, and I'm not kidding you, they want John Deere to do their Office 365 migration. Who has any idea? I mean, do you really think that the people who work for John Deere is that is IT consulting their core competency? Yeah, I don't think so. So, but whatever. I just bring that up because if you guys are making business decisions about who you're going to do business with and who you're going to partner with in order to get your projects done, to get your system set up, you need to be using the right decision criteria. Don't ever utilize the size of the business as your decision factor criteria. The size of the consulting firm or the size of the business is absolutely no indicator whatsoever of the talent of the individual that will actually be working on your project. But yet, the talent of the individual, the talent and the experience of the individual working on your project is the probably the sole delineating factor for you as to the success of that project or the failure. And you know what? You, as the customer, are going to be the person and the business that reaps either the rewards or the detriment of that. So, as I said, this example of this company that I've been working with recently, where this former, IT service provider set up their Office 365 tenant, they have literally lost all of their emails that were older than 2 years because they chose to do business based upon price. They chose that service provider based upon price, which is also an incredibly wrong factor to be making a partnership decision on. So they don't even have somebody to go back and sue. I mean, they can't go back and sue this company for, gross incompetence and negligence and anything like that. And then you have to actually even ask the question whether or not that's even worth it. But that company's out of business now. So, I guess if your approach to business decisions is thinking that you're more interested in having somebody to sue, then fine, go ahead, go and partner with the bigger companies. But that I would suggest you're better off just to have the stuff competently set up to begin with. So back to multi-factor authentication. The only people that have had issues with multi-factor authentication at this point in my experience are people who are very, very naively believing that their short-term convenience is more important than their long-term time. So let me explain that. The short-term convenience is, yes, your authentication process is going to be a tad bit longer. I mean, to the tune of probably 10 seconds longer. Comparatively, if your account gets hacked, you're now going to have escalation support to the tune of potentially thousands of dollars. And besides the fact you don't get to choose the timeline, the bad guys get to choose the timeline for you. And you don't have any control over what they've compromised and what they've done with it. And it can very easily take you months and months and months and months and months to unwind this problem. So, I had a particular issue where I naively thought that I could outsource the management of my website, and I hired a professional web developer. Unfortunately, their lack of knowledge about how to actually properly secure a website and their lack of absolute dedication to multi-factor authentication resulted in my website getting compromised. Now, I actually think that the people who compromised the website were intentionally doing so in order to try and infect me and my on-premise environment because I'm a very attractive target that way, which that never worked because of the many, many, many other layers of security that I have in place. And what I ended up finding was even after I had hired another web developer, literally one of the best web developers companies in the nation, to unhack my website. Yes, they were able to get rid of some of the hack, but they were not able to get rid of a very significant chunk of the hack. It was only through my own dedicated work over a period of months that the website finally became fully unhacked. I kept finding little remnants of things here and there. And then It's now fixed. But what I'm telling you is that you can actually end up spending months and months and months of your life trying to unwind something. And depending upon what it was that was hacked, you may not be able to actually get it back to the point where it was before. I mean, with a website, yes, it's absolutely conceivable you could just like start with a new website and start over. And in fact, that's what one of the web developers suggested to me. And I said, okay, so now I should pay you $5,000 for a project because you can't figure out where the hack is so that you can undo it. So I basically rejected that on its face. And I went about the business of just securing the website myself and really doing the due diligence to learn about it. So I know a tremendous amount of securing about securing websites now, just simply because of having to go through that effort. And it was definitely well worth it. And what I ended up finding in the process was that the vast majority of people that are in the business of developing websites for people, they really don't have any true understanding of how to secure websites. And I know this because when I talk to people that have websites, they're not using multi-factor authentication, and MFA is bar none one of the most effective ways, if not the most effective way, to keep people from maliciously authenticating into your website on the administrator side. You have things like GeoIP blocking that you should be doing. You should obviously turn on MFA. You should be using a custom administrator URL. You should even be doing administrator IP whitelisting, meaning unless your authentication attempt is coming from one of these IP addresses, forget about it, you can't even authenticate. And you should also be doing things like SCP encrypted file transfer. But yet I still see web developers using FTP. I see them sending passwords in clear text and emails, and every time I see that, my head wants to explode. I'm like, you people are clearly not, you shouldn't be in the business of doing website development for people if that is your password exchange mechanism. I mean, I'm astonished by it. It's as if they don't care about the security of their client's infrastructure. So I say all of this to you because, number one, go use multi-factor authentication on everything you can possibly enable it on, please. Especially your Social Security Administration account. Because if your SSA account gets jacked, it's really bad doo-doo. Clearly, if your Office 365 or your Twitter or your LinkedIn account gets jacked, that's also bad doo-doo. But in the case of you having your own website, if you should not be relying upon what you think is the capabilities of your web developer. You should be asking yourself the question, am I using multi-factor authentication to log into the administrator section of my website? And if you're not, then you should fire that web developer and get a new one. And I say that very straight up to you, that they should have advised you from the very beginning to use MFA. They should be using it themselves. And if they're not, then what they're doing is they're choosing their own convenience over the security of your infrastructure and your business. And that is not the right choice to be making. Well, that is it for the show today. I am going to talk on the next show about various browser plugins and anti-ransomware resources that are available that you should be utilizing.
Support for WGTD comes from Kenosha Harbor Market, featuring Wildflower Bakery, offering a variety of muffins and breads. Kenosha Harbor Market on 2nd Avenue and Plaza New Way is open Saturdays from 9 to 2. Online at KenoshaHarborMarket.com.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, Kenosha Area Family and Aging Services invites you to a 60s-themed evening of food, music, and more on August 11th from 5:30 to 8:30 p.m. Advance tickets are $20. For more info, visit kafasi.org.
Hi, I'm Bob Tenuta of the Gateway Radio Reading Service. We volunteers read the local newspapers to the visually impaired over the radio. Would you like to do the same and not having to move one toe out of your home? Call me at 564-3870.
This is WGTD. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to a discussion of local educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Dwayne Olson, a retired member of the teacher education faculty at UW Parkside. Karen Sconsert, an associate professor of education at Carthage College, Mike Kehoe, a retired substitute teacher and a current special education support